Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is, can America's alliance relationships be repaired? Today's episode is part of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I'm sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me today to discuss President-elect Joe Biden's plans to rebuild relations with America's allies are Matthias Matthes and Sheila Smith. Matthias is Senior Fellow for Europe at the Council and Associate Professor of International Political Economy at the Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. Since 2019, he has also served as the Chair of the European Union Studies Association. Sheila is Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council. She is an expert on Japanese foreign policy and politics and has written widely on both topics. Her most recent book is Japan Rearmed, The Politics of Military Power. Matthias and Sheila, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure.
In one of the rites of an American presidential transition, foreign heads of state call to congratulate the president-elect. That tradition played out last week after the race was called for Joe Biden, as Democratic leaders in Europe and Asia all quickly picked up the phone to offer their congratulations. When President-elect Biden was asked what message he intended to convey in these phone calls, he said, "I'm letting them know that America is back. We're going to be back in the game." Now, we can discuss Biden's plans in a minute, but I'd like to start with your assessment of the premise of Biden's comment, namely that the Trump years deeply damaged relations with U.S. allies. Is that, in fact, the right diagnosis? And Matthias, if I can, I'll begin with you first.
I think that is, from Europe's point of view, absolutely the right diagnosis, right? I mean, the last 4 years of a Trump presidency from the point of view of Europe have been traumatizing. Here was the first time since World War II a president who was openly anti-European integration. He was pro-Brexit. He actually encouraged other countries to leave the European Union. When it came to NATO, he refused often, and more often than once, to commit to Article 5 of NATO, the article that kind of commits the alliance where an attack on one member state is an attack on all. And so if you followed the European celebrations on Saturday after the Tuesday elections in the United States, they were widespread and there was this kind of sense of relief in Europe, even so much so that certain opinion polls would show an increase of 20 points in approval rating in many European countries. So I do think there is this big sigh of relief that many European leaders and European people, frankly, saying, finally, we can restore some of our kind of traditional relationship of cooperation and common values and so on.
So Sheila, how does it look from the vantage point of Japan and America's other allies in East Asia?
Thank you, Jim. I think the story of alliance management during the Trump administration, of course, is the Abe-Trump relationship. Japanese Prime Minister Abe was very quick to reach out personally to then-President-elect Trump before he actually assumed the presidency in 2017. So you have a story for Japan that is a relatively positive story in terms of the Prime Minister's ability to build a personal relationship with a fairly unpredictable and maybe unorthodox presidency in terms of foreign policy. Others in the region, President Moon didn't assume office, of course, until months into the Trump administration. He was a bit on his back heels in terms of that relationship building. And of course, we've got Australia, which ran into the president's position on asylum seekers and immigration early on in the Trump presidency. So you've got a mixed bag. I think the repair theme is not maybe as equally applicable to all our allies in Asia. I think the Japanese in particular look at an incoming Biden administration and worry a little bit about their policy on China, but we can talk more about that later.
Should I make anything of the fact, Sheila, that current Japanese Prime Minister Suga did not send a gift, as best I know, to President-elect Biden the way that Prime Minister Abe flew some 9,000 miles out of his way to deliver a gold-plated golf club to then-President-elect Donald Trump?
It's a great story that Abe gift-giving and his visit to Trump Tower, of course, is sort of legend for the Trump administration. I think there's two things here. One, obviously, is there has been a transition in Japanese leadership from Prime Minister Abe to Prime Minister Suga. And so, in effect, our election result announced on Saturday that we now have a President-elect Biden is met with a different Prime Minister. Had it been Abe, I think there may have been some awkwardness. I don't know that for a fact. But of course, it would have been more delicate, right, in the personal relationship side. But I do think that Prime Minister Suga, of course, fully understands that our transition was difficult and will continue to be difficult. But as soon as President-elect Biden was announced on Saturday, Prime Minister Suga did phone on Sunday to congratulate him on his win. So I think you've got a little bit of distance in Tokyo now from our politics, not the direct personal ties that you see or that you did see in the 2016-2017 transition.
Matthias, I want to go back to a point you raised, and you noted that in the immediate aftermath of the declaration of Joe Biden as president-elect, public approval ratings in Europe for the United States went up. And there's sort of a bit of a bookending here, given the interest that you and Sheila both have. If you look at the most recent Pew Research Center poll, it suggested that many European countries look very unfavorably upon Donald Trump. In fact, Belgium, a country you know very well, is at the bottom of that. Only 9% of Belgians have confidence in President Donald Trump to do the right thing, and only 24% of Belgians had a favorable view of the United States, whereas Japan was one of the countries sort of at the upper end of that scale, being much more favorable to the United States, thinking more highly of Donald Trump. And so I'm wondering, is sort of look at public opinion, given the fact they can move so dramatically in a short period of time, what lesson do we infer from that? Does it mean that the public just sort of move back and forth depending upon personalities, or is there some longer term trend in attitudes, public attitudes in Europe that are going to constrain what their leaders can do in terms of working with the United States?
Yeah, there's definitely back and forth. I mean, all of us are old enough to remember the transatlantic fallout over the Iraq War, right? When Donald Rumsfeld was keen to divide Europe in old versus new Europe, where some of the oldest allies, France and Germany, of course, opposed the Iraq invasion, while newer members of the European Union and Eastern Europe, but also the UK, Spain, Italy, and so on, were in favor. But I recall at the end of the Bush administration in 2008, approval ratings in Europe were very low of George W. Bush. They shot up the moment Barack Obama was elected president. In fact, the approval ratings of Barack Obama were much higher in Europe than they ever were in the United States, right? So I think personalities matter a great deal, but there was a deep sense, even though there was discomfort between George W. Bush and his kind of lack of multilateralism prior to 9/11, leaving the Kyoto Accords, leaving the ICC, things that Bill Clinton had committed to, that put Europe and the United States on a collision course. But there was something unique, I think, about the Trump administration's embrace of kind of authoritarian leaders, some of the kind of opponents of the European Union, especially Vladimir Putin, that was just, you know, unique in that period. And there's a big sigh of relief with Joe Biden, because Joe Biden is a kind of old-fashioned Atlanticist politician, right? He looks first to Europe when it comes to seeking allies. And in that sense, it's even a bit of a restoration from the Obama administration, frankly, where Barack Obama was very keenly and clearly focused on Asia.
Sheila, can I ask you the same question, just looking certainly at Japan, a country you know exceedingly well, but maybe even South Korea, other countries, sort of what the public mood is looking at this new administration? That is, are people happy to see, to borrow Matthias's phrase, a restoration? Or is it the sense that there's still a bit of leeriness lingering under this? I noticed there have been a spate of articles written in recent weeks about, can allies trust the United States? And they typically come with some quote that some variation on once bitten, twice shy. So can you sort of give us a sense of sort of what the really the public mood is toward this?
Sure, happy to. And I think, again, as background, it's important to understand that the public mood in both Japan and the ROK particularly.
ROK being South Korea.
Right, South Korea, on President Trump's coming into office, was very much anxious about, you know, this new president, given the campaign language and the way he talked about these two alliances during the campaign. But they kind of restored themselves, you know, the traditional kind of Japanese-South Korean support for the U.S.-Japan alliance or the U.S.-ROK alliance continued to be in the 60 percentile. Donald Trump hadn't really damaged the confidence in the alliance. I think the public mood on the Trump presidency in Australia may look a little bit closer to what we saw in the NATO countries. There you had deep divisions inside the body politic of Australia about what this new turn meant for American democracy, what kind of leader President Trump was, the values piece that Mateus was pointing out about European response. But I think what you see now in the Biden, I think certainly in Australia, the initial response has been an exhalation of sorts. And so I think you see Australia looking a lot similar to the European allies' response to President-elect Biden. Again, I think in South Korea and in Japan, I think there's the geopolitics of Asia come into the equation here. So it's partly, is America still credible? As you pointed out, Jim, this question of, have we been bitten? Are the politics really in the United States, are they really going to be, you know, of a restoration sort of mindset in terms of the way America approaches its relationships with its allies? I think there's still some worry there, but I think there's a real focus on how important the U.S.-Japan alliance is to Japan and the U.S.-South Korean alliance is to South Korea. And that's based on the behavior of North Korea, obviously, on the peninsula, and the behavior of China writ large across the region. So you've got different factors, I think, playing in to the public's view of our new president-elect.
Well, let's focus on specific policies. And I think given where you just ended, Sheila, let's sort of focus on sort of the suite of security issues that both Europe and Asia have to deal with, and they don't overlap entirely. Again, Matisse, let me begin with you, and maybe we can talk about NATO. And to what extent is a Biden presidency going to be good for NATO, whatever that actually means? And I'll notice coming against the backdrop, certainly of the Trump administration's decision to begin a drawdown of some troops from Germany, leaving others behind. So can you give us sort of a read on what the Biden presidency means for NATO, at least from a European perspective?
It's a very good question, because I think the NATO issue for Europe is part of a broader return of the United States to multilateral fora, right? So when it comes to the pandemic, it's the WHO. When it comes to trade, it's the World Trade Organization. And of course, the Paris Climate Accord. So NATO is a big part of this broader multilateral puzzle. So I think a few things where a Biden administration will be very different for Europe from a Trump administration is, number one, there's going to be no doubt as to the commitment to NATO. So I think everybody who works in NATO headquarters in Brussels has sighed. My sister works there, so they have sighed a big sigh of relief. I know that to be a fact. The commitment to Article 5 and common defense, I think, has been restored, is there. But think about a few things, right? The commitment to democracy, I think, is something that Joe Biden is much more strong on than a Trump administration, right? So he will be tougher when it comes to Turkey, Poland, Hungary, when it comes to those countries kind of backsliding on the rule of law.
Let me ask you on that, if I may, Matisse. What would European countries want a Biden administration to do beyond the rhetorical condemning violations of the rule of law, suppression of journalists and the like? Are there specific concrete acts they want a Biden administration to take, particularly given that when you talk, for example, of Hungary, this is an EU member, and the EU presumably has a variety of steps it could take if it were willing to take them to send a message to Budapest?
I think you've actually answered your own question. I mean, the main thing the Europeans want an American president to do is condemn them, right? Mm-hmm. Not to give them this kind of, you know, free movement, if you want. I think it's especially true in the case of Erdogan in Turkey, where, of course, the EU has less direct influence. But it's incredibly hard for the European Union to be chastising Poland and Hungary that they're backsliding on democracy when they're getting support from the American president that they're not doing it, or that it's not all that important. There is no formal mechanism, of course, to kick out NATO member states. But that being said, the commitment of a Joe Biden administration to have a summit of democracies, right? This is in many ways a double-edged sword. On the one hand, I think many people who value democracy and rule of law want to see this happen and want them not to invite Poland, Hungary, and Turkey. Because the problem is, when you do invite them, then you send a message that they are indeed democracies, right? So this will be actually a very tough nut to crack for the Biden administration.
Let me ask you another question that's going to affect the Europeans much more, I think, than Japan or many of our allies in Asia, and that is Iran. Obviously, the Trump administration in May of 2018 walked out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal that was signed in 2015. Trump administration pushed forward this maximum pressure strategy, which has clearly put it at odds with its closest allies in Europe. How do you see that playing out? Can that gap be closed? I know Biden has talked about rejoining the Iran nuclear deal, but he hasn't said he would rejoin it without conditions. He has laid down at least some notional demands of the Iranians.
I'm afraid that the Europeans are a bit naive on this front, right? I mean, now, similar with trade tariffs with China, Biden is not just going to get rid of them. He's going to use this as leverage, right? So I think Joe Biden is committed to the Iran deal that was negotiated, of course, when he was vice president by Secretary of State John Kerry. Does he like to rejoin it? Absolutely. But he probably, and I imagine advisors, would like to toughen up that agreement. And that will be a non-starter for the Iranian regime. That being said, getting them back as a part of a broader conversation on how to contain Iran, on how to stop further enrichment of uranium, I think will be valuable. And I think it's something Europeans, and here actually the UK, Germany, and France agree for once that this is necessary. But I think it's also part of a broader re-engagement on European terms that they want to see a Biden administration engage in the Middle East. And that's not just Iran, but also Israel-Palestine, right? Where a Trump administration has very clearly aligned itself with Benjamin Netanyahu's policies, which has, of course, you know, been very hard for the Palestinian cause, which Europeans are much closer to that cause than the United States.
Well, I have to ask you quickly on that point, Matthias. What has the European reaction been to the Abraham Accords? Obviously, the Trump administration offers that up as indication of the great success of its Middle East diplomacy and the wisdom of working closely with Benjamin Netanyahu.
It's actually gotten very little coverage in the European Union in general, because they don't see this as these were countries that weren't particularly at war to begin with. So is a peace accord really that big a deal if it doesn't, you know, change much on the ground, even though, of course, diplomatically, these are important things. But the European Union and the big three, London, Berlin, Paris, still look very much to the Middle East through the eyes of Palestine, right? And they feel that the second class citizen status that they still have and the kind of one-sidedness of these deals that the Trump administration has struck is actually make it even harder for the Palestinians to continue to make their case for statehood and things like that.
Sheila, I want to talk about some of the security issues in Asia. Let's face it, the big one is China. And there's a lot of concern about a much more assertive Chinese foreign policy, whether we're talking about what's been happening in recent months in the Himalayas, or we're talking about the sort of slowly rising coercion toward Taiwan. My sense is that this has alarmed many people in Japan, understandably so. It's their neighborhood. So how do you see the issue of China working in U.S.-Japanese relations? That is the Biden administration going to be able to deliver the kind of reassurance that Japan wants?
So China, as you point out, Jim, is the huge elephant in the middle of the Indo-Pacific. And so I think it's not just Japan, but it's our other allies across the region are all grappling with what we're grappling with, of course, which is tremendous exposure in terms of our economic interdependence with China, but also the growing alarm, not only over the traditional military security issues, such as, you know, free and open access to the world's oceans, but also, you know, the increasing complexity and qualitative improvement of Chinese military capability, and then increasingly into the next generation of our technologies, information technologies, and the extent to which China may be able to penetrate our ability to defend ourselves in these, what they call the new domains of cybersecurity or space. So huge strategic security agenda for the incoming Biden administration. Japan, to start there, is a little concerned that the Biden administration may go back, as they say, to engagement as opposed to confrontation.
Japan favors more confrontation, I take it.
They'd like to see the United States be more confrontational. And this is important. This is delicate balancing act,
so
right?
Tokyo's willing to hold America's coat.
Right. So it's the U.S., Japan, China trilateral relationship that gets very difficult to get everybody on the same page, even though Japan and the United States are close allies. And we agree on many of the issues, I think, that we would want to coordinate on. We are probably as closely aligned as anybody on the China problem. that doesn't mean that everything we want to do and coordinate on is doable in Tokyo or doable from Washington's point of view. So there will be a need for a very intense, I think, and consistent conversation between Tokyo and Washington on how do we coordinate, what is the level or balance of risk. The United States physically, as you know, it's not as close to China as Japan is. And I think that's one of the premier challenges for our Asian allies, not just Japan, but you know, all the way through the Philippines, right, South Korea, et cetera. They are right next door to this growing regional power. And I think this last year, Jim, it's been really interesting. China has taken the opportunity of the COVID pandemic, or at least it's been perceived to be taking an opportunity of American absence to put pressure on Asian nations, especially U.S. allies in the region. So witness the trade frictions and the attempt to use economic instruments of coercion between China and Australia. Very intense conversation right now between Canberra and Beijing and a very confrontational approach by the government of Prime Minister Morrison. They don't want the Chinese to be telling them how to run their democracy. They don't want Chinese intervention in Australian domestic politics and have really called the Chinese on some of their behaviors. And so, of course, when President-elect Biden starts to talk about a, you know, consultation among democracies, to Australian ears, this sounds very, very good because it allows the values piece of our alliances, not just the power piece, right? Our military power, economic power, but the values piece to come to the fore, as you pointed out in your earlier discussion with Mateus. So in Asia, there is relative comfort and discomfort with this values piece. And I could speak to that if you'd like me to, but it's not uniform across all of our Asian allies. Japan speaks a good game, and I'm not saying that to be cynical, but the Japanese government of Prime Minister Abe and now Prime Minister Suga is increasingly thinking about the way it will bring new tools to its foreign policy to respond to China when it attempts coercion, either against Japanese citizens or against values that are shared by other democracies. You know, Japan has been very outspoken on its Indo-Pacific vision, a networking of regional powers, democracies first and foremost, that can join together collectively to take action in the security, economic, and also in this values area vis-a-vis China. So it's a complex set of issues here, and not every ally has a cookie-cutter approach, but we are seeing a much more assertive China, and I think the demand for greater U.S. engagement in thinking about how to build that coalition more forcefully.
Well, certainly, Sheila, one of the big issue areas in which that engagement is going to take place is in what we might call the economics trade space. And if we could sort of stay in Asia for a bit, over the weekend, we had the signing of RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, of which China, I believe, is a member. The United States is not. Can you sort of give us a sense of how countries in the region are viewing how the economic and trade issues might unfold? Because obviously, on trade, Donald Trump upended a number of years of American trade practice. And are Asian countries expecting a Biden administration to come in and provide the restoration, to go back to the term that Tia used earlier on, or are they expecting some variation of the same American policy?
So this is the complexity of our domestic politics, Jim. I think is I don't know if it's widely understood, but it's a slightly bemoaned across Asia. As you know, the Obama administration negotiated the Trans-Pacific Partnership and was ready for, along with Japan and Australia and others, was really ready to sign what they would call a high standards trade agreement, which would incorporate some of our complaints about the former trade relationship we had in North America with our Canadian and Mexican partners. What they wanted to do was to bring in better labor, right? Coordination of labor laws, better environmental protection mechanisms among trading partners of this Trans-Pacific group. And that included people in Asia, in Latin America, as well as South, as well as North America. So it was a very high standards oriented, let's lead the way in Asia with these countries that are very highly productive and wanting to liberalize their economies with each other. We, of course, under the Trump administration, that was one of the things that President Trump decided in his first 100 days that he was withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This was not what he wanted to do. Prime Minister Abe, for years, tried to persuade him that this was something that the United States belonged in, right? But eventually had to give up on that. What I think you're seeing with RCEP is, as you noted, RCEP is a, if TPP was the high standards, gold standard trading agreement, RCEP is, I don't want to call it lowest common denominator because it sounds like I'm criticizing it. I'm not. But it's for a group of economies that may or may not have the same domestic laws, may not have the same domestic foundations, maybe developing economies, maybe already developed economies. So, and it's largely, it includes China, of course. The TPP did not include China. So you have a large trading agreement, and now the United States is absent from the two defining multilateral trade initiatives of the Asia Pacific or the Indo-Pacific. So we withdrew from TPP, which is now called the CPTPP, thanks to the
Canadians. Say that three times fast.
CPTPP. So the Canadians put a couple of extra letters in there just to keep us on our toes. So the High Standards Trade Agreement, which actually would have been very much in American economic interest had we been able to do it. But the RCEP, of course, we were never in it to begin with, but we are now absent in the region of the world that is most economically diverse, most economically dynamic, and most integrated with China. And so we've lost our voice, quite frankly, in the regional trade realm. And I think this is going to be a challenge for President-elect Biden, because I'm not sure the American people yet see their interests as being served by trying to get back in, for example, to the CPTPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think there's still a debate to be had here in the United States about whether or not new multilateralisms in the trade sphere are really in American interest or not. And I think for our Asian partners, especially our allies, this is an absence of the United States that they think is really, it's a defining indicator of whether or not we're still going to be around and interested in shaping the region and its relationships a decade or two or three decades from now. Without our economic presence, I think this is a huge problem for Japan, Australia, and others in the region.
I'll note on that point that during the campaign, Joe Biden was very clear in saying that he wasn't going to do any significant trade deals until he had made a down payment on his pledge to address problems at home. And obviously, if things continue the same way where we have divided government, it's going to be very hard for a Biden presidency to make a big down payment on those ambitious domestic policy proposals, something to watch. But, you know, Matthias, let's look at it from the European perspective. My sense is the Europeans have a lot of grievances with U.S. trade policy recently, whether it is talking about the tariffs that the Trump administration placed on steel and aluminum imports. We have the reality that the Europeans sort of haven't sort of stood still in the last 4 years. It was a big trade deal, as I recall, between the EU and Japan. And obviously, internal problems within the EU with Brexit. And many of my friends in the United Kingdom have a great deal of optimism about how the United States and the United Kingdom are going to negotiate a wonderful free trade agreement. So can you give us some sort of sense of where the debate on trade and relations with the U.S. on trade are going in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely. We've come a very long way, right, in transatlantic trade and investment relations from TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which, you know, let's not forget, the biggest opposition to that agreement came from German civil society groups, right? From environmental groups, from consumer rights groups, and so on. And this from a country, Germany, that is a world champion in exports, right? Is a very big export-driven economy. So I think there is a sense in much of Europe that this is not coming back, right? A big transatlantic...
It was an Obama administration initiative.
Yes, absolutely. It was, and so that was put on ice by the Trump administration, and I don't think it's going to be revived anytime soon. Even though, I mean, as Sheila was mentioned about gold standard trade agreements, everybody involved always felt, well, these are too rich parts of the world with very high labor standards, environmental standards. So it should be relatively easy to come up with a free trade and an investment agreement, especially given that there's already so much integration transatlantically between the two, the European Union and the North American economic space. And so it's understood that there's very few free traders left in Washington, D.C., right? The few that are left are usually tenured economists in academic departments, right? And they're not so much making policy anymore more as they were in the 90s and the 2000s. And I think the hope of Europe is actually to give a new lease on life for the World Trade Organization, right? Where already under the Obama administration, there was frustration on the American side with the appellate body and the kind of judicial downside of this, where now I believe it's clear that, number one, a Biden administration will probably take out the tariffs and basically reset trade relations with Europe to where they started under the Trump administration. And because these are allies and Biden's foreign policy team has already made it clear that this is a priority for a Joe Biden presidency to kind of restore the trade and investment relationship transatlantically. And then I think what Europe and the United States will want to work on is to see if they can revive the WTO's appellate body and things like that. But that's where they actually have a common interest. And I think it would be easier for also developing countries and so on, because that's for them a more important forum than these kind of bilateral deals. Now, when it comes to Brexit, I mean, we're still, as we speak today, if we can believe the reports coming out of Brussels, they're now in a tunnel for the negotiation, which means the final stage where there's no leaks to the press, where they hopefully will come up with some sort of thin free trade agreement. And with thin, I mean, this is going to be a bit like NAFTA, right? It's going to be just no tariffs, no quotas, but lots of friction at the border. So that is coming on January 1. And I think once that's set, it's still not clear, these negotiations could still fail, then technically the United Kingdom is free to strike free trade deals all over the world. Now, I'm a little more skeptical than your friends in the UK, I imagine most of them in London, that there's going to be all that much enthusiasm from the UK public for these trade deals. Because in the end, if you look at it, what do the Americans want? They want agricultural access. They're going to want pharmaceuticals. They're going to want financial services. And these are the kinds of things where it's not clear that the UK will gain all that much from this, number one. And number two, when it comes to values and standards and things like this, UK citizens are much closer to the European single market, right? And so then here we go again, the God-given right of every Englishman and every Scot to have chlorinated chicken and genetically modified organisms. I mean, it's going to be a very tough sell domestically that this is about taking back control, right? And so I think the domestic politics of free trade deals in the UK are actually just as hard as they are in the United States.
I should note, Matthias, in citing my friend's optimism, I wasn't necessarily endorsing that optimism. I share your sense that the domestic politics on both sides are, how should we say, a tad bit more complicated. Look, there's a third suite of issues I really wanted to jump into, and we might just sort of label them transnational issues, and of two of which really are at the forefront, climate change and the pandemic. Quickly from your sense, Matthias, do you see any significant progress in these areas? Is this a place where Europe and the United States can come together, or are we more likely to get some sense of a lot of airy rhetoric, promising good deeds, but a lot of elbowing and shirking on the ground?
I'm actually much more optimistic when it comes to cooperation on the pandemic than it comes to climate change. And it's mostly because of US domestic constraints, right? So, I mean, I think what was striking for anyone looking at Europe in March, when Italy and Spain were the hardest hit by COVID-19, is that there was a complete absence of American presence on the ground, of American leadership, frankly. And so you had these Russian planes and Chinese planes landing in Rome and Milan and in Barcelona with like help and nurses and PPE and all these sorts of things, masks. And it felt that America was just not there and not interested. And that was very strikingly different from 2008-2009, where under first Bush and then, of course, Obama's presidency, America was leading the G20 and a way out. And because, of course, there's a public health aspect, but there's also an economic aspect to this, right? So a kind of clear coordination on both, I think, is something that a Joe Biden administration, I mean, they've said this is going to be their number one priority, getting the virus under control in the United States, but learning from the various experiences in Europe, I think there's a lot of things that can be coordinated. Now, on climate change, not that I'm a climate change denier here. I mean, I very much think this is incredibly important. But I am afraid that the one big thing that Joe Biden administration will do globally will be to sign on to the Paris Accords again. That's very easily done. And then, as everybody who signed it, the question is domestic, right? I mean, how much money are they going to put behind this? How much change when it comes to technology, when it comes to, you know, weaning yourself off fossil fuels, is the Biden administration going to want to do? And that's where, and you mentioned it earlier, where divided government in Washington, D.C., and it looks like it will be that way. And even if those two Senate seats in Georgia go to the Democrats, it's going to be very hard to govern, right? Both in the House and in the Senate, where it's going to be incredibly close. And it's hard to imagine even moderate Democrats signing up to very ambitious climate change plans or a kind of Green New Deal or anything like this. So I think Europeans will be more disappointed on climate change than they will be on pandemic cooperation. But that could change. And also, let's be honest, I mean, Germany, which is probably going to be the closest partner in Europe of a Biden administration, they're all talk as well when it comes to climate change, right? That, of course, could change in September next year if, as many expect, the Greens will join a new government, the first government post Merkel, but we can talk about that later.
Sheila, what is your read on how these issues are going to play out in Asia? I should note that many Asian countries have done a far better job than the United States has in controlling the pandemic. So I assume for them, this is an issue of a different level of priority. But that said, do you see opportunities for cooperation or for division here?
Yes, I think the first thing that needs to be said, Jim, is that the shock in Asia about our response or lack of adequate response to the pandemic has done an awful lot to shake confidence in the United States. And I don't say that in a partisan way. I think it's a reality from Taiwan to South Korea, obviously Japan and other countries. The conversations I have had with people are not about which president is coming next as much as what happened. And I think it's real because I think our listeners need to understand that America has always been technologically competent. It has always, as Matteo said, it's always been a leader in some of the readiness and preparation for global pandemics. It has always taken a stand that it ought to be out front. And so the absence, again, of the United States here in the regional conversation and the withdrawal from the WHO in particular has really puzzled people but shocked people as well. So again, I think you find in Asia very similar to what Matteo was describing for Europe. I think there's an appetite for the United States to get back in. Please come back. Shape policy, even if you have to do a tug of war with China and the WTO, please don't abandon the WTO to China. And again, this is the lens through which many of the Asian countries are viewing our pandemic response and obviously climate change. I don't think climate change is as big an issue in the region as the pandemic is. But I think it's also seen through the game of great power competition here between the United States and China. So Australia has also invited Chinese ire by calling for an investigation of the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic in China. It wants a larger set of transparent understanding about how it emerged, how it was spread, what needs to be done. So that's one piece. The second piece is there is a desire for the United States to be at the forefront again, or at least in the pack, in thinking about how a vaccine will be distributed across the region. So you have countries like Japan, Australia, South Korea, talking to ASEAN countries and talking to India, of course, also about building infrastructure for vaccine distribution. Japan also has a vaccine under trial. It hopes to be maybe not as quick as us, but certainly quick out the gate. Because the fear is not only do we need to solve the problem of COVID-19, and provide the infrastructure and the response needed across a very diverse region, but we also have to not cede the ground to China. And so China and Russia both have been very aggressive in offering up their vaccines, their solutions, in much the same way China offered its PPE and testing kits and such. So I think there, again, this geostrategic competition that's playing out first and foremost in the Indo-Pacific, but which has global implications, also colors the way that many Asian countries and especially our allies are looking at our pandemic response. Just a very brief note on climate change. The new Prime Minister of Japan, Prime Minister Suga, announced that they want Japan to be carbon neutral by 2050, which is an interesting announcement to make at this particular time. But it goes to show you that, you know, as many people may remember, Japan had a natural disaster in 2011 that really compromised its nuclear power generation. Not only compromised a particular nuclear plant in Fukushima, but it also paralyzed the domestic political debate over the place of nuclear energy generation in Japan. And of course, Japan is very heavily dependent on other countries and the import of natural resources. And so nuclear power has always been seen as a kind of self-sufficiency tool, right, for the Japanese in terms of energy production. So what Suga is doing, I think, is reflecting the reality that's surrounding the nuclear debate in Japan, but he's also moving the conversation on renewables and investment in renewables and conservation forward. So that's an interesting thing to watch. I don't know yet how it dovetails with a global climate change agenda.
I want to close out with one final question. It may be very unfair to ask both of you this question, but I'll pose it anyway. And that is, what do you think the narrative is going to be a year from now? Are we going to be talking about how Joe Biden has restored American alliances? Are we going to be reading articles about how alliances remain in disarray because the United States is an unreliable partner or a partner that can't deliver on its promises? Are we going to be reading that alliances are in disarray because our allies are all talk and no action? Something else? So just put on your prediction cap. What do you have for me? Matthias, we'll go with you first.
I think, Jim, in a year from now, we're going to be all breathing a sigh of relief that everybody in the rest of the world is criticizing American leadership again, rather than criticizing a lack of American leadership. So it will be very reassuring for all of us foreign policy types to keep hearing this. I do think there's going to be more critical tones, right? Because, I mean, it's a lot of the trends that were underway in transatlantic relations were well underway before Donald Trump. I mean, it's not Donald Trump who said that the Europeans need to spend more on defense, right? This goes back to, of course, Bob Gates, but also Obama repeated this and so on, right? I mean, on the one hand, Europe is very keen, and this was very clear from Angela Merkel's congratulatory statement to Joe Biden. So happy, America is back, this is great. We share values. He knows Europe. We know him. I look forward to talking to him again. And then immediately also, but we also need to do more, right? And the Europeans always say that. But when it comes down to actually doing more, it immediately becomes like, oh my God, what does that mean for NATO? If we do more and then what? And so I think we're going to be back to that more familiar sort of story. And I think that's probably already going to start in the Munich Security Conference, where many Europeans are expecting Joe Biden to make his first big statement of foreign policy.
Sheila.
So yes, I think America is back is an interesting refrain. Prime Minister Abe, when he got back into power in 2012, came to the United States early in 2013 and told Washington, Japan is back. And so for us Japanese specialists, the America is back refrain is kind of interesting. Here's the challenge, I think, for the Biden administration. I think hopefully Matthias is right. We will be criticizing American leadership and lack thereof or ineffectiveness thereof or direction thereof. And I'm looking forward to that. But the challenge is not just restoring our old policy, our pre-Trump era alliances. The challenge, and I think the president-elect has put this out on the table, that he wants to lead coalitions of allies. That is complicated. It takes a lot of effort. It takes our partners wanting to be on board those coalitions. And I'll tell you one thing that's not as appreciated as often as it probably should be, at least in the Asia part of our foreign policy portfolio, is there are others who've stepped up while we've been absent. And Japan is one of them. You know, Abe gets a lot of credit for managing our new president, kind of unpredictable new president. But what the Abe cabinet also did is navigate around the United States quite effectively. So whether, as we talked about the trade sphere at CPTPP and the European-Japan agreement, there's other ways in which the Indo-Pacific strategy and engagement with others in Asia have also shown a Japan that's really quite willing to lead on its own. And our allies are getting used to working in the room without us. Doesn't mean they don't want us there, but we are not necessarily going back into a world that says, America, tell us what to do, even if that was not really always the case in the past. This is a place where we're going to have to find our seat in coalitions that may have already been built in the interim. And the geopolitical shifts in the Asia-Pacific or Indo-Pacific in particular have accelerated to a degree that you've seen adjustments again in Japan, in Australia, in South Korea, in India, adjustments without us. And yes, absolutely, they want us back, but we shouldn't be going back as if we are going to save the region once more. This will be a much more contested space for what that coalition should look like and even for what the American role in the coalition should be. So hold on to our hats for people like us. This is going to be very interesting territory. And I think at the end of the day, President-elect Biden and his team will welcome the input from allies, even if it's not always going to be comfortable in every policy area or set of objectives.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Matthias Matthes, Senior Fellow for European Studies, and Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council. Matthias and Sheila, thank you for joining me. Excellent conversation as always.
A great pleasure.
Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.